Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Logistics Podcast. As always, Andreas is with me. Good evening, Andreas.
Hi, Tobias. Nice to meet you.
So, as you can hear, we are starting in English, which is usually not our language. But today it's necessary and very important to talk in English as we spread this podcast episode also to Max and the supply chain helm. Inspired by Connect Chains and Tino Jurgel. So we are talking about, we mentioned the series Connect Chains Unfiltered, and I'm very happy we have two more guests here this evening. So I'd like to welcome Lila Ricard. Good evening, Lila.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming around. And we also welcome Florent Chanet.
Shani, well done.
Shani, perfect. So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So what we want to talk about today is managing stock in humanitarian logistics. Andreas met these guys last year in December in Berlin. And maybe, Andreas, you can give a little introduction about what we are talking and how this podcast episode started in Berlin last year.
Yeah, so Lila and Florent won a prize last year in December on the Connect Chains, the Lindsay Fritz Medal. You won it with your team for your project, the Stockholm platform we talk about today. And so Lila, you are like a deputy project manager at ESAP's Welthungerhilfe. And responsible for the tool. And Florent, you are project director as well as ESAPS and Welthungerhilfe. Would you like to do a short introduction of yourself? How did you get to the Welthungerhilfe? I think Lila, you can start if you like.
Yes, sure. Well, I've done most of my career in the humanitarian sector, in emergency response, in Central Africa and in Central America as well. And I was working mainly in this question of logistics coordination. How do we make sure we are a bit more efficient in what it is that we do, in how we help people in emergencies? And at some point I came across this ESAPS initiative and its Stockholm platform. This is how I met Florent. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I want to know more. And here I am. It's been 3 years now that I'm with the project and trying to contribute to that very nice initiative.
Okay. Florent, would you go on?
Yes, thank you for having us. So yeah, I've been doing this career of humanitarian logistics for the last 25 years, slowly transitioning from disaster response operation in mostly in Africa and in the Pacific towards more and more disaster preparedness, as I saw that if we want to have a good response, we need to be well prepared. And so I created this this first iteration of this platform a few years back until the project started to grow. And I had some team coming together, including Lila, which I'm very glad to have on board. And that's how we came to develop the project and to finally win this prize end of last year. So that's how we came to here.
Yeah, so our audience is mainly from the business environment. So it would be very good to have a short introduction. So Flora, could you give us some insights about what the challenges of NGOs are and what ESOPs and the Stockholm platform is supporting?
Yes, well, that's a vast question about the challenges of NGOs. Today, there's quite many. Obviously, the biggest one is related to funding. The industry has been And the institutional donor have been slowly cutting funding over the last years and decades, but there was a bit of a coup de grace last year after the Trump administration dismantled USAID, which represented roughly half of the funding of the entire industry. So obviously, and it was only the start of a domino effect, as we saw, you know, many other governments, including France, Germany, Netherlands, Spain, Australia, and many others similarly cutting their funding. So that's definitely a massive issue at the moment and a challenge. There's more. We can see that the geopolitics are changing, that our industry is dealing with more and more conflicts. There's also more and more disaster because of climate change. So we are in a situation where we have more and more needs, but less and less means to respond to that. And on the specifically on our industry, we also see in the recent years, specifically last year, that humanitarian workers tend to also become more and more of a target, which was not so much of the of a problem. It was a problem before, but not to the scale we saw recently. So we're combining quite a lot of challenges. Some are new, some are just evolving from what we've seen before. But to answer the question, I think I will focus specifically on our question of supply chain and stocks. And so, I mean, it's related to what I was saying to start, but we see a massive cut in funding. And obviously, supply chain represents around 70% of any disaster response operation. So, and a big part of this supply chain are stock related. So we found, as when we started the project, that we have a lot of room to be much more efficient in the way we organize that stock, and hence the reason of the project, trying to be more collaborative, to avoid duplication, to maximize supply chain efficiency. And that's one of the problems that led to the creation of the project, which is a complete lack of coordination, no visibility on what everybody else is doing. So there was very much a silo approach, which is another challenge we're trying to address. And I guess that's probably some of those challenges might be similar in the private sector, but they are very specific to what we've been trying to do so far.
Okay, so that's quite a challenging environment you're working in. So Lila, could you explain a little bit about the functions of the Stockholm platform? How do you cope with those challenges?
Yeah, I guess also complementing on what Florent was saying, something sometimes hard to understand for actors from private or business environment when looking at the humanitarian sector is that we fundamentally don't work in the same way because we don't have an objective of efficiency as such in the very essence of the way we were created. Our core objective is to save life, no matter what it takes, right? So the starting point is completely different. And the way the sector was built was not to save money and make a lot of result, but it was to do as best as you can. So it created to a lot of inefficiencies, and especially, as Florence was saying, in the supply chain. So it led to a system where each and everyone buy their stock. We don't really know what the other have. It's not very well mapped. It's not very well informed. It's very much each and everyone in their little corner, and there is no pressure to do it differently because it has always been done in this very chaotic way, let's put it that way. And it works like this because we have emergency in our blood. So you just go from one emergency to another and you adapt, right? So the logic of Stockholm was very much to try to put a bit more order and visibility in the stock aspect of it, right? So to do it ahead of a disaster, what we call the preparedness moment. So when it happens, it's too late. We just have to figure it out. So we really take the time before and we look only at stock because it's very easy also in this sector to try to solve everything. We want to solve the whole supply chain from starting point to delivery. And we decided with Stockholm that let's start with trying to do it correctly with stock by just mapping it. So the very function of Stockholm is mapping the humanitarian stock that is available in any given country ahead of a disaster. Everywhere in the world. That's the ambition. And it might sound extremely simple for from someone in the business industry, I can imagine, but it's a massive challenge in our sector. So it's just to map it, what each different organization have. And we also offer the possibility, once we have the mapping information, the very baseline data for stock, to try to analyze it and provide recommendation. So we choose Stockholm because it's the name of a city. It sounds nice. It refers to a city also that is connected by bridges, that is various islands connected by bridges. So it's very this idea of putting together the information. And it's also because it refers to the very concept of stock and the idea of not going any further. Let's try to do stock correctly and then we will figure it out. So that's Stockholm in a nutshell.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's quite interesting. And I guess from our business point of view, Andreas, we can say it the same way as you just mentioned. It's not easy also for a business entity to find your stocks over over a global scale. So absolutely understand what you're talking about. So Florent, you were part of the team who realized the platform. Lila just mentioned it was over several organizations. So it was an approach to find a way to connect several things like bridging in Stockholm. Looking at it, which steps were taken to realize this trans-organizational transparency tool in stock of humanitarian materials?
Quite a few different approaches to make that happen. When I started with that project back in 2017, I was with the World Food Programme at the time, and I opened the Pacific office. And I spent 10 years in the region before, and I knew that the core of what I needed to do was not to reinvent the wheel. There was a lot of small logistic initiative, and the point was to connect them. So we had something like 120 partners over the region, from NGOs to governments and national disaster management offices, national authorities in charge of coordinating the response. And when we started with the idea, we had a lot of pushback in the sense that Lila just kind of referred to that just before, but our industry is not very different from many others in the sense that there's a lot of trust issues in our industry for all sorts of reasons, good or bad, or misunderstanding or real historic reason. But there's always a bit of trust issues. And when it comes to sharing information, everybody wanted it, but everybody was a bit cautious about how we would get there. So the approach we've taken at the time was to focus on what brings people together, and it was the fact that there are similar needs, even if they were different players. And we focused on the similarities rather than focusing on the differences. And you know, it's the same approach that we focused on the solution rather than the problem, because, you know, when you look at a problem, everybody else is the problem. It's never yourself, you know. But when you come at the solution, everybody wants to be part of it. So by bringing the focus on the solution and on the similarities in the need expressed, we try to basically trigger a momentum for partners to join. And in some way it worked. We had a good connection. The Pacific is, even if geographically it's super vast, it remains a very small region when it comes to humanitarian actors. So it was relatively easier to start there than it would have been in Asia or in the middle of Africa. And the other approach, and I think Lila referred to that as well, but we really triggered the idea saying, we will address the question of stock visibility and nothing else. You know, there's lots of organizations who try to do everything everywhere, and they end up diluting a bit their skills and know-how into a bit of everything, but really clearly on nothing. And we decided to do one thing, but to do it properly, and the idea to start small and then to let it grow from there. And these are basically the main concepts that has led to the fact that we did that. We started small. We started in a region on one topic, and then from there we grew. And then I think there was a bit of a snowball effect, because it was such a need in our industry to have this visibility on stock that as soon as we started to provide this as a service, well, it started to interest bigger players in different regions. And so we let the snowball effect play a bit on that. And now we have today, we have, you know, we have UN agencies, we have NGOs, we have government, we have the Red Cross, we have quite a lot of different partners. So I think we've achieved these trans-organizational players you were referring to before, at least partially for now.
So when you offer this visibility, we talk about tents, about medical kits, about different items. And from a business perspective, if you manage a warehouse, there's always the question, what is one piece? And are five packages one piece, or is one piece one piece? So Lila, how do you make sure that all organizations speak the same language regarding the stock levels and the data that is used, that one tent is one tent, for example?
Yeah, no, it's a big challenge, even starting with the fact that about when we refer about speaking the same language, we literally don't. Like, we've been invited to a podcast that literally is held in German with a French speaker. We work in regions. I every day work in regions in Latin America and the Caribbean where they speak Spanish, Swahili for Democratic Republic of Congo, where we have tried to make some progress. So the starting point is already extremely complicated when it comes just even to language. So imagine when we start talking, when we open the Pandora box and we say, oh, let's talk about your items and your supply chain and the way you do it, etc. So I think it would be false to say that we have solved it. I think it's a constant work in progress to say we are going toward the direction of harmonizing the way we work. And to me, the very, very starting point on that is the posture. We can't say, do that way, and it's going to work. That's the reason why the humanitarian sector suffers from the image it has nowadays and the inefficiencies it has, because sometimes the approach is to impose because it's more efficient. We're in the middle of an emergency. We have to find a solution. Let's just do it that way, and that's it. And I think as we work on one single topic and as we do it ahead of a disaster, now is the time to pause and to listen. So that's why we, in the team, we speak different languages as the language, and we try to take the time to hear what it is that they need, the users, the different organizations, the Red Cross, the UN agency, even private sector actors that we try to involve in the SOCOM platform to understand how they could be part of this big effort, right? And then we try to find solutions that are more, that to me are much more linked to the art of compromise and that work for everyone. So you were referring to a tent, right? Every single actor in the humanitarian sector has a different way to call a tent, to label it because it has a specific brand or specific functionalities or specification, as we say. Or sometimes they will register it in Stockholm in the in their own languages. So in Spanish for Honduras, for example. So what we have found as a solution is name harmonization through an item group. So you will create your item on Stockholm, but you will link it to an item group. And when everyone will do a search looking for tents, the categoric tent will display all the tents. And then you go into the details and you see how each and everyone have created their own tents. But we believe that at the time of an emergency, we need to know what is the specificity of your tent, if it's a family tent, an individual tent, a storing tent, etc. So we have this these details, but you need also to have the big picture. So we're trying to find the compromise and to navigate on that. So we find this was a good fix that we have found and a good compromise that kind of brought everyone to the same table, because each time we present the platform to a new organization, they're like, oh, but I label my item this way. And we're like, no problem. You label it the way you want, but just you link it. So that was a good fix, but we have many other to comes, mainly because the people we work with, the very user of the Stockholm platform, they are logisticians. They are logisticians working in remote areas where there is not a lot of connection, where the day-to-day is extremely heavy, and they don't have the time for fancy IT technological solution. So it's very important to be careful about, I have a perfect solution for you, but it's extremely complicated. You have to connect to download the app, etc. So it's again about finding the compromise of what is going to be easier for them. And that's why it was super interesting for us at Berlin to meet with Max Meister and to discuss, for example, how do we do with people that just have a WhatsApp or Telegram and they send their stock update and it just updates in the system without any further extra effort, etc. So that's really the mindset we try to have and trying to find this kind of solution for our users, basically.
So you always try to keep it as simple as possible, and you start from having nothing to having something, and at least you know we have something organizations call item tent, and if you know there are hundreds of them, then you can ask what kind of tent is it, and you can intensify the communication on it. Okay, understood. So Florent, setting up technical meanings is one thing, but you already touched it in the beginning. Transforming the way people work together is completely another thing. Everybody who has done a digital project knows that. So how do the organizations adapt to using your Stockholm platform, and how do they start to change their processes?
We've touched on that before, but you rightly put it together. The platform itself is not the complicated part. I just would like to bring just a compliment to previous answers, because I touched on that. A difference in the languages is also that we, like Lila and I, for instance, we are logistician. Okay, our job is to manage supply chain during operation. When we develop such a platform, we talk with tech people who work in the digital sector, who develop platform, and we, by developing that, we also had a problem of not speaking that same language, because we come with very specific needs. You know, I want something that looks like this and that does this and performs this action, but how does it translate technically before? That's another challenge in terms of speaking the same language. And that comes a little bit to that question about how do we adapt to that. The question of building the platform, we'll find a way. We find people who have the skills, the technical capacity, and can understand our request and translate it into technical needs. The real question is around how do we overcome the obstacle of trust, for instance, which we've mentioned before. You know, in the last few decades, I would say, everybody was complaining about funding, but now we have a real reason to complain about funding. And if I want to put it that way, there was not a lot of incentive to force or to really push on the collaboration, because everybody could more or less afford to do their own thing on their own corner. Everybody was complaining, but nevertheless, that's what everybody was doing. So, you know, when I started at the beginning of this podcast to mention that the closure of USAID later, last year was quite a blow to the industry. Something positive might come out of that is that at least it forces all the industry to really look at collaboration, because there's no more choice. If we really want to remain relevant and efficient and to support people who really are affected by crisis, and we know there's more and more of that, we have to find other ways to work. And the way to work is collaboration. So, you know, I think there was a bit of, you know, collaboration washing in the last few years. It was very nice to say, are we going to collaborate? But it was not really taking place as much as what we've seen since last year. And now I feel that there's really something changing in the industry, where people in charge realize that the only way for their own survival, I'm not questioning their ethic or their engagement, but just basically speaking, the only way they can survive so that they can help people is to join forces and collaborate. And I think we've seen quite a bit of that over the last few years. So the USAID situation might come up with something a bit more tangible and practical than we expected. It might be a good for a bad, if I may say.
Very interesting. What you just mentioned, how things came up, and the process of cooperating and collaborating between the organizations get up. So Lila, taking a look back, you just mentioned before, it starts with different languages, different descriptions about items. Where did you see the fastest progress of things happening? And looking at it now with a perspective of looking back, where is still a lot of room to improve?
I think if we have a geographical look, of course, as Florent mentioned, the projects that started first as a pilot in the Pacific. So it's where we saw strong adoption by what we could call small organization or very grassroots or national organization. The Red Cross, the Tuvalu Red Cross, for example, is a very strong user of the Stockholm platform, or national authorities in the country, where they really took ownership of the tool and made something out of it. Because they relied on each other, on neighboring countries in rather small countries, very dependent and very exposed to natural hazards and disaster. And we saw the same in Central America over the last 2 years, where when I joined, I started to promote the platform over there in Honduras, in Guatemala, in Panama. And we also saw the same appetite for this very simple, okay, let me start to do my mapping so that I share with others. So, for example, we were in touch with the logistics hub of Panama, and they're going to try to map what it is that they have, what it is that the civil protection has. So we see this snowball effect happening for the the very basic information of stock mapping. People play by the rules of the game. So that's working well when it comes to the platform itself. Then we try to provide a bit more advanced recommendation for per country, where we have an algorithm that provides an analysis. And we don't necessarily see an appetite for that yet with our users. Maybe it's too advanced. Maybe it's not user-friendly enough, that part, at least if I have to reflect. But the stock mapping, the very function, basic function, works well. And that's why, for me, it takes always takes me back. And when we have conversation with Florent, what should be the priority, what should come next, etc., to me, it's like, let's keep it simple. Let's keep it simple, let's keep it user-friendly, and let's make sure we are adjusted to our user feedback, right? And what I can see also overall is a bit always this discrepancy where when it comes to rather big country, or what we could call big humanitarian operation, Ukraine, South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, it's much harder to make progress because things are so huge and it's hard to find people that have the availability, the time and interest to really work ahead of a disaster. On the contrary, in smaller countries, they know that every year they're going to be exposed to the same disaster and they need to come together. Then we make like more tangible results, right? So we have a bit like this discrepancy. And I think for us, the challenge is really to adjust to their needs. So some might just need a system to easily type the information into the Stockholm platform. We need to have a manual data entry. Others, we need to build APIs and connect with them with their warehouse management system. And others, it might be a hybrid solution where we just do what we call a data dump, where we plug their data and we take them. So it requires us to constantly adjust to make sure we are talking, we are offering the right thing to the right organization. And we're talking more than 150 different organizations, more than 900 users. So it's hard to make sure that we are offering something that is perfectly adapted and adjusted. For what's coming, I would say that Eastern Africa, the whole area around Mozambique, Madagascar, Malawi, also is showing a lot of interest and needs, because every year it's the cyclone season and every year we see a lot of floods and affectations, such as very recently in Mozambique. So we are hoping we can put the tool at their availability and really be of support over there. So that's what I would share for now for where we are.
Hey, thank you very much. So it's a little bit comparable to business projects, where sometimes the project team is way ahead regarding the function of a tool in comparison to the user. It sounds a little bit like that. What do you think can so you have a big digital project with a lot of stakeholders? Is there anything businesses can learn from your project, or how would you estimate the situation compared to perhaps projects you know in other fields?
That's a good question. Look, to be honest, I don't think technically, or at least on a digitalization perspective, I don't think there's much we have to teach to the private sector. I mean, everything we develop today, we develop it from the private sector and with the private sector. Someone told me one day, I'm from a generation where Google was not a verb. I'm definitely from that generation. And, you know, I'm showing off because I can mention API, but a year ago, I didn't know that what it was. So not everybody's from my generation, hopefully. And there's a new generation coming that will be much more versed into that those technology and to be much more capable of having those discussions directly with the developers. But generally speaking, the humanitarian industry is decades behind the private sector when it comes to technology and digital infrastructure. I mean, we're not even using barcodes on half of the stock we have on the planet, which is to tell you how far back we're going. This being said, to answer your question, the humanitarian industry operates in a very different context and setting than the private sector. The private sector objective is to save money. Yeah, it's to make money, generally speaking. I mean, of course, there's social responsibility and there's genuine engagement, etc. But the essence of the business is to make money. And so in order to do that, they try to be as lean as possible at every point of the supply chain. In our industry, we do think that would be the worst nightmare of a private sector. I mean, prepositioning stock, where you're going to fill a warehouse with stock that are going to stay there for years or, you know, until they're being used. It's the worst thing you can do in the private sector. You know, that's the last way to be lean and to save money. So we operate in different ways for different reasons. Lila touched on that before. Our principal objective is not to save money, it's to save time. The first 36 hours are critical, and we need to be ready, even, as she mentioned, if it comes to make things that the private sector would see that as a worst possible process. What I'm trying to say is that while I don't think we have much to bring to the private sector in terms of technology and digitalization, we have a specific way to look at our industry because we operate in a different context. We operate in time of uncertainties, okay? We don't know where the next disaster will be. We don't know how many people will be affected. We don't know in which capacity they will be affected. And therefore, we operate in a way where it's very complicated to anticipate and to be prepared, okay? And this way of working forces us to take different angles and different perspectives on the way we're going to prepare ourselves for the supply chain or for the way we're going to respond to different crises. And I think if there's something we can bring to the private sector, it's maybe an opening of the different views and the different challenges that need to be taken into consideration in a world that's going to be, unfortunately, less and less predictable. And we are really good at unpredictability when the private sector is something that they're more learning than we are. So I think that's where we have a nice way to collaborate between the technological knowledge of the sector and the unpredictability of the environment we're working in. And I think that's where we can bring something to the sector, most likely.
Yeah, the topic of becoming resilient is quite new to the business sector, because if you get totally lean, you have no overcapacity anywhere, and if something changes from the thing you as expected it to be when you designed it to be lean, then you have a real problem, and that's the problem of constraints in the business world we face at the moment. So it's a good impulse to check the different views and to accept the unknown, I would say. Yeah.
And we see it today with what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz and the problematic on not only on oil, but fertilizer and everything are just consequences. And the private sector are taking a hard hit because of that unpredictability. So, yeah.
So, Lila, do you have any plans for further developments of the platform, of the Stockholm platform, or is it more a regional spread? You plan what is the future of the platform?
And maybe just before mentioning that, we love to build on each other's comment, because it's always this long debate, and this is how we proceed with trying to identifying what should be the next priorities that I will mention in a minute. But I think I would go thinking about this link with the private sector and the humanitarian sector. There has been a lot of forums where we try to build alliances, etc., and standard agreement and memorandum of understandings, etc., right? But I very much agree with the way Florent describes it. It's this ability to get inspired or get slightly reshaped by the way the other is working. To me, it's really the importance right now, especially in what we are witnessing, in promoting more porosity between the different sectors. And it doesn't have to be institutionalized. And to me, the way we have exchanged with Max, with you, Andreas, when we met in Berlin, it's really this approach of how it is that you work, how it is that we work. Because very often we have this vision of the humanitarian sector, the industry, as Flora mentioned, we consider ourselves even as an industry, right? As a word of its own, because it's in countries where no one would dare to go because it's too complicated, because we have lost hopes, because we don't speak the language, etc. So no one touches it apart from expert humanitarian actors. So now we have a strong and long institutional knowledge about that, but alone we can't do anything about it. We never do humanitarian responses without the private sector. And at the end of the day, we work very much with them, but we always consider them as a specific category. To me, it's the same with the social sector in Europe. So we say, he works in the social environment, providing support for people that have needs. It's humanitarian work as well. Why don't we learn from that as well, the way we do it in Europe or in other country, and we cross-fertilize knowledge? So to me, it's really, there is this need right now for each and everyone to slightly adjust the posture so that we can really generate meaningful conversation, nothing that have to be standard or institutionalized. But having said that, yes, it's true that we have a very strong focus at country level for Stockholm, and hence at regional level, so where we want to engage with which country. But more than anything, we try to have a tool that is made available to the humanitarian community and to countries. So whoever wants it can seize it and tell us, hey, I'm using it, please, I would like to see this, this and that. And if we can do it, we will. And then at as part of the technical team, we also try to define what should come next as a global features, let's put it that way. So for example, we are very happy because in a few days, we're going to release an inbuilt messaging system in Stockholm. It's been a while that we were working on that. And for us, the point is you are able to map the stock. But if you see a stock that is of interest for you, you can click and reach out to the person. And we discover how complicated it is because you have to respect the rules of data protection and things like this. So it's not just as simple as it is. So we have that inbuilt messaging system, for example, and a feature that we really want to develop is an anticipation analysis in the coming months. So it's one thing to be ready. Preparedness is ahead of a disaster. Consider nothing is happening. This is the information you have. And now let's have a filter of, and what about is a cyclone is coming that direction? Or if we know we have a prediction that floods are going to affect that specific area, how should we redispatch the stock collectively? So that's something we would really like to work on. And we've been working with the different university to try to build that and factor that in the Stockholm platform. And of course, we try to also follow the, not the trends, but the need and what we see from the private sector, as Florent was mentioning, and they're all this questioning around having an app, for example. But these are things we don't know about. We have no expertise. So that's where we rely very much on advice from the private sector, from what would be needed, what would make sense, the cost of maintenance, is it sustainable, etc. So these are a few, let's say, hot topics that we have on the table.
Okay, so the platform gets more intelligent, you could say, and more or you add more communication. I think that's the most important thing. Yeah. So thank you very much for sharing insights about the Stockholm platform and your organization. If anybody who's interested, or if anybody listens who's interested in learning more, he can we link your website in the show notes. And if anybody, as I mentioned, you won the Lindsay Fritz Prize or medal, if anybody is inspired by your story and by learning about it, and if somebody knows a comparable organization, it's still possible to apply for the Lindsay Fritz Medal till the 5th of May. So we also link the website for the for the medal, if you like. So thank you very much for joining us, for explaining the platform. And so we come to our last question everybody has to answer in our podcast. I hope you have brought something too. Is there any media, book, film, anything you want to share that could inspire our audience? Do you have something to share? Florent, would you like to start? Or?
Yes. I'm going to do a bit of a French promotion here, I'm sorry. But I'm going to give an answer, although I'm not a big gamer. Again, it's not very my generation, but I play sometimes. And you may have heard about this game that was released last year called Expedition 33. And there was a game award in 2015, and it won 9 out of the 11 prizes. And the reason I would mention that, also, they would have I've had plenty of movies and books to mention, but it was inspiring because it was made by a very small company in the south of France. They started, the three of them. They were trying to have a couple of guitar players to do a pro bono music and something, and they started something very small And with a team of 25 people or so, they managed to rock the entire industry and to build something that has won every single prize. They do now, they're touring with the musical of the movie, of the game. And I think it was inspiring because it proved that if you have a good concept, a good idea, you get the right people as part of your team, which is a critical part of the process. And then you don't give up in the face of what everybody will tell you, the reason why it's not going to work. You can definitely get there. So yeah, that was quite inspiring for me. And I'll just take this this one more minute before Lila share her inspiration to thank you guys for having us here. That was very nice to have the opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much. We put it down into the show notes. So Lila, it's your turn.
I really liked to see that question. I think it's really inspiring to take the time to take a step back now to reflect on these things. And I try to not give it too much thought because I can be a bit of an overthinker. And to me, what comes to mind is Democratic Republic of Congo as a country, of course. It's what has inspired me, the complexity, the richness, the beauty of this country has made me the humanitarian worker I've wanted to be when I wanted to understand what was happening in this country. And I think it really represents the complexity of the humanitarian sector and also the disconnection, because most of people would say, I don't understand, it's too complicated, resources, politics, violence, let's leave it away, right? And there are really precious media production that were done around this country and about this country and by people from this country that are passionate. I can think of the Congo Tribunal. It's a documentary, the Virunga documentary also. It's on Netflix, I think. The journalist Colette Breckman, she has wrote a lot of books about Democratic Republic of Congo that made me want to know even more about this country. One of them is called Lumumba, about the independence leader of DRC. And it's really, really inspiring. And it gives you really the pulse of a country, not just about the headlines of what is complicated about it. And I think it's really important to always reconnect to that and to the inspiring part of what makes a country, and the people of Congo are pretty inspiring figures for me. So yes, that would be the few reference that that I've shared.
Thank you very much. We also put them into the show notes so you can follow them. And if you need some more stuff, you can get into contact with Lila, talking about maybe some more books about Congo. Guys, thank you very much for coming around and to this podcast show, talking about your chances you took, the systems you built, and the problems you're trying to solve in a very unpredictable sector with a lot of problems. We are happy you have been here, sharing your view on it, and also your Stockholm project here. And from our point of view, we wish you all the very best. We hope to support from our business view to your sector. And if anything comes into your mind, just give us a hint, and we are trying to help in a way. It might proper help. So, dear audience, thank you for listening to today's episode. We're very happy you stayed with us until the end. And we will, listen next time on next Friday in the typical episode on our podcast. So thank you very much for coming around. Thank you very much for listening to us. And see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.